This is podcast number 164 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I want to share the wisdom of James Russell Miller. I made a new friend this morning. A member of our group, Elizabeth Little, introduced me to him. He wrote a piece about pictures in the heart, and by the time I got through reading it, I thought, this is someone I have to get to know better. I believe his name is familiar among Presbyterians, but I'd never heard his name before. His name is James Russell Miller, and he was born in 1840 and died in 1912, and Pennsylvania was home. Let me introduce him by way of the foreword in a biography of him written by John Ferris. Dr. Miller was too much occupied with things deemed by him more important to give any attention to the selection and putting aside of material concerning his life. He was so busy writing and speaking and living and loving with the shaping of the lives of others in view that he took no time to think of the world's interest in his life. It never occurred to him that there would be any demand for the story of his life, and he discouraged the efforts of friends who sought to gather material for biography. Yet Dr. Miller was the author of the truest possible description of himself. He did not think of it as a description. In giving it, he was only telling the reality of his faith in his master. But all who knew him agreed that the description was true and accurate. He said, "Jesus and I are friends." This is the story of the life of Dr. J. R. Miller, told in 5 words. Dr. Miller gave glimpses of his life in his books. Whenever he wrote to others of things they should do from day to day, he was telling unconsciously of things he was doing himself. This fact is apparent from the brief quotations from his writings on the page following the beginning of each chapter in this volume. These quotations, taken together, help to fill out his own descriptive statement, "Jesus and I are friends." I love that. When he died, he didn't want any flowers on his grave or eulogies offered. Although people gathered far and wide to share memories of him and lessons learned from this gentle soul, he said, "Let us seek to make our lives immortal, not in shafts and monuments, not in riches and earthly honors, but by making the world better, by putting touches of beauty into our lives, by teaching and blessing little children, by encouraging the weary and disheartened, and by comforting human sorrow. Then we shall need no grave with its marble memorial to keep our name alive. We shall live in the things we have done." Aren't those exactly the words you would expect to come from a friend of Jesus? So, of course, my mind always wonders about the childhood of such a person, about their home life. And here are a few glimpses from Ferris's biography. I think you'll recognize some of the same methods you are incorporating into your homes. The poets were his great delight, and his mind and soul were enriched by many of their treasures. It was his habit to try to reproduce from memory sentences and paragraphs which impressed him, thus making them his own. Then he would write original sentences and paragraphs modeled on those of the masters. He was fond of illustrations that would be like windows through which the visions of the soul might become real to others. He took equal delight in studying the book of nature, which was spread out so entrancingly before him. Long walks in the country increased his love for God and God's world and all mankind. His associates knew that his life was renewed by daily contact with him, whom even then he was fond of calling his friend. When he gifted his brother a Bible, he inscribed, "Read this book as a letter from the dearest of all friends." There was no holier-than-thou spirit about him. The home in which religion was given such prominent and constant place was not the abode of gloom. The children were glad to spend the evening in the company of their parents. Music was their solace during many of these evenings. They would sing together, or James would play on his violin. Frequently there would be a guest in the family circle, and the conversation of these visitors did much to shape James's purpose in life. So, with that brief introduction to who he was, let me share this piece I read this morning called "Pictures in the Heart," and what a beautiful vision of a well-educated heart it is. Niebuhr, the distinguished traveler, became blind in his old age, But having traversed many lands amid the fairest and loveliest scenes of the world, he had stored away in his memory countless pictures of landscapes, mountain scenery, valleys of rare beauty, and great and splendid cities. Then as he lay upon his bed or reposed on his easy chair, his face would often brighten into a rich glow as if some inner light was shining through. He was pondering once more some splendid scene he had looked upon in the sunny Orient. The chamber walls of his memory were hung all over with pictures which filled his darkened years with joy and beauty. It mattered not to him that the light had gone out, leaving thick gloom all about him. His heart was his world, and there was no darkness there. No putting out of sun could obscure the pictures that hung in that sacred house of his soul. In a far truer sense than many of us are aware, do our hearts make our world for us? The things we behold are but the shadows of the things that are in us. If we have bright pictures in our heart, the whole world, wherever we go, will be a lovely picture gallery. Every scene will be a panorama of beauty. The most repulsive objects will wear a tinge of loveliness. On the other hand, a somber, cheerless heart clothes the whole world in shadow and gloom. A writer says a cold firebrand and a burning lamp started out one day to see what they could find. The firebrand came back and wrote in its journal that the whole world was very dark. It did not find a place wherever it went in which there was light. Everywhere was darkness. The lamp, when it came back, wrote in its journal, "Wherever I went, it was light. I did not find any darkness in all my journey. The whole world was light. The lamp carried light with it, and when it went abroad, it illuminated everything. The dead firebrand carried no light, and it found none where it went." Just so men and women go through the world, and returning, write records of observation just as diverse as these. Some find only gloom in the fairest paths, and amid the lovely scenes, nothing beautiful. Others find nothing but beauty and brightness, even in the deepest valleys of earth. Each one finds just what he takes out in himself. The colors he sees are the tints of his own inner life. Many people move amid unbroken music, hearing not one note. So, in a spiritual world full of heavenly presences, men remain unconscious of the love and companionship that linger about them. Having eyes, they see not, and having ears, they hear not. Their sorrows go uncomforted, while the Comforter stands close beside them. The world seems dreary and cold, while tender warmth and rich beauty lie close around them. This is true in our commonest life. How many of us find all the good there is in our lot? Do we extract the honey from every flower that blooms in our path? Do we find all the gold that lies in the hard rocks over which our feet stumble? Do we behold all the beauty that glows along the ways of our sore toil? Do not many good things pass through our hands and slip away from us forever because we even recognize their loveliness or their worth? Do not angels come to us unaware in homely disguise, walk with us, talk with us, minister to us, and then only become known to us when their place is empty and they have spread their radiant wings in flight, which we have no power ever to recall? The baby seemed very troublesome as it broke your night's rest with its cries, and you were compelled to rise and care for it. But when it lay bashed and still, forever among the flowers, what would you not have given to have heard it cry again? We never see the beauty of our friends until they are vanishing out of our sight. While they are with us, we are impatient with their faults. Their habits fretted us, but when death touched them, it clothed them in a garb of brilliant beauty. They appeared transfigured. Out of the dull, faulty character sprang a radiant angel form and hovered just beyond our reach forever. What joy and blessing it had brought to our lives to have seen the beauty and the worth before the vanishing. So it is in all life. It really takes but very little to make anyone happy. Yet there are many who cannot extract even a reasonable happiness from a world of luxuries and blessings. There are some who see nothing to admire in the most magnificent collections of rare works of art, while others stand enraptured before the crudest picture. There are those who will go through a forest on a June morning when 1,000 birds are warbling and hear not one note of song, while others are thrilled and charmed by the coarsest bird note that falls out of the air. One man sees no beauty in the most picturesque landscape. Another finds some tender bit of loveliness in the barest and most ragged scenery. One cannot find pleasure or contentment amid the most lavish abundance. Another finds enough in the sheerest poverty to give deep happiness and evoke hearty praise. In nothing does this distinction come out more clearly than in the way the ills of life appear. One class of people see nothing but ills. Everything wears to them a somber aspect. Smallest trials are magnified into crushing disasters. All troubles look exaggerated to their vision. These see nothing but adversity in all their days. They find some cause for discontent in the serenest circumstances. Then others find only blessing wherever they go. Their sorrows are struck through with the glory of God's love. In the chapel at Pisa, the dome is so constructed that sounds uttered below come back in a delightful response of melodious music, and even a discord is converted into a harmony as it floats up into the resonant vault and returns to the ear. Such a dome hangs over these souls. Even the painful and discordant things are changed into rich harmonies. Life seems different to different people because their hearts differ. One man listens to thrilling music and is not moved. Under the same strains, another feels his soul kindled into rapture. The first has no music in his own bosom to interpret the melody that strikes his ear from without. The other has a singing angel in his heart that responds to every sweet note that breathes through the air about him. "You must have the bird in your heart," says someone, "before you can paint it in the bush." It is not then half so much the outward in life that we need to have changed as the spirit of the inner life. The cause of discontent is not in men's circumstances, but in their own spirit and temper. Get the song into your heart, and you will hear songs all about you. Even the wailing storm will be but music for you. Get the beauty and the good into your own soul, and you will see only beauty and good in all things. Get the peace deep into your own life, and you will find peace in every lot. Our hearts make our world for us. The things we see around us are but the shadows of our inner experiences, which are cast outside. The things we hear are but the echoes of our own inner thoughts and feelings. Pictures in the heart fill all the world with ugliness or loveliness. So let me close this podcast with just a few more words of encouragement from Miller to you mothers. The work you may do may be unheralded to the world, but you are the living force that will decide the future of our world because you are tending to the inner lives of your children. Here's this first illustration. The battle was over. Two mighty armies had met in terrible conflict, and the earth had quivered beneath the shock. Great destinies had been decided. After the battle, gentle women came upon the field and went quietly and quickly among the wounded and dying with water and wine and food and words of cheer and kindness. There was diviner power in the ministry of these angels of comfort who came after the battle, when all was still, than in the awful force of the battle itself. We are strong only as we are gentle. Gentleness is the power of God working in the world. We may learn the finest arts of life, music, painting, sculpture, poetry, or may master the noblest sciences, or by means of reading, study, travel, and converse with refined people, may attain the best culture. But if in all this we do not learn love and become more gentle in spirit and act, we have missed the prize of living. It matters not how much Bible reading and prayer and godly teaching there may be in a home if gentleness is lacking. A child must have love. Love is to life what sunshine is to plants and flowers. No young life can ever grow to its best in a home without gentleness. There may be fine furniture, rich carpets, costly pictures, a large library of excellent volumes, instruments of music, and all luxuries and adornments, and there may be religious forms, good instruction. But if gentleness is wanting in the family, the lack is one which leave an irreparable hurt in the lives of the children. There is a legend of a great artist. One day he had wrought long on his picture, but he was discouraged, for he could not produce on his canvas the beauty of his soul's vision. He was weary, too, and sinking down on a stool by his easel, he fell asleep. While he slept, an angel came, and taking the brushes which had dropped from the tired hands, he finished the picture in marvelous way. If only we strive to be pure and true, to each of us all there will come an hour when the tree of life shall burst into flower and reign at our feet the glorious dower of something grander than we ever knew. I believe that with all my heart. Bye-bye. See you next time.